Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Inspire Health Podcast. And today's guest is Joseph Selby. And we've been excited to talk to Joseph for a while here. We had a little bit of back and forth, and we finally managed to nail down our time. And Joseph is the author of Physics of God, The Yugas, and Break Through the Limits of the Brain, How Neuroscience Supports Spiritual Experience. That's this book right here. And he's known for creating bridges of understanding between the modern evidence-based discoveries of science and the timeless experience based discoveries of the mystics. I think this is an area that we really benefit from, especially where we are currently. We always want to understand mentally what's going on when we have these really significant experiences. It always helps us kind of bridge them. Is there a method to actually access that again? So Joseph is a dedicated Kriya yoga meditator for nearly 50 years. He's taught yoga, meditation, and universal experiential spirituality throughout the US and Europe. Joseph, what a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Well, my pleasure indeed to be on.
So I've been excited to have a chat with you because we've had lots of conversations around the idea of the superconscious and what sort of lies beyond this sort of five senses of this physical reality. And what I think will be a neat aspect of this conversation is that we're going to tie it into almost like, how do we actually access it that's almost a little bit more step by step? And what do we need to change from a brain perspective in order to make the connections to actually be able to access these different awarenesses that are there for us, but it just seems like they're almost difficult to get to for the average person. So Joseph, maybe start off with, from your perspective, what is the superconscious awareness? How do you describe that?
Well, first off, we all have access to it. Superconsciousness is more who we really are than what we experience on a daily basis, which is tied into the senses, it's tied into body awareness, and it ends up being circumscribed by those inputs, where superconscious is beyond that. And superconsciousness is the area in which saints live. It's the area in which inspiration comes from. It's the area in which intuition comes from. It's who we are, but we've limited it, our awareness, so much that we need to break through those limits in order to experience it again. But it's always there, and it is wonderfully joyful, peaceful, loving, as well as expanding.
So you said that it's actually more than we really are, than what we even experience through the five senses. Can you dive into that a little bit more and help people understand what we mean? How is this outside of what we can sort of taste, touch, feel, see? How is that more real than that, which we tend to think is really the only reality in a lot of ways?
Well, I think one of the ways to understand that question, to answer that question, is to understand that we already are that. We already are that superconscious. And in fact, we have simultaneous awareness of both our physical reality and more subtle realities. And this is a little hard to grasp, that we could have both at the same time, that we could be connected to subtle reality, that we could even be experiencing subtle reality without knowing it. And one of the things I like to share is that according to experiential spiritual teachings, and according to certain disciplines within physics, we simultaneously exist in this higher reality, and it is from this higher reality that we get our thoughts, that we have our emotions, that we recall our memories, that we get our life force. So this expanded reality, this subtle reality, is really more of what we are than the physical body, much more. But we just don't realize that we're having this simultaneous experience. Science tells us, mainstream science tells us, that all of those things, consciousness, ideas, memories, emotions, all are produced by the physical brain, where the saints and sages, the mystics, tell us the brain has nothing to do with them, but they come from this subtle reality of which we are always a part. But they just, we don't know it as well as we know the physical body. It's like we're preoccupied with the physical body and begin to feel from an early age that all of our reality is that. We don't realize that we're simultaneously tapped into this much greater reality that's based in superconsciousness.
Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking to another guest a while ago, and this conversation came up around this concept of the greater reality and all the different levels to it, and was saying something very similar, the idea that that's actually much more real. And when you experience it, there's a certain knowingness, a sensation in the body that you can't put aside. And he said, from his perspective, he said, a lot of those are more real because they're closer to who we truly are. You're actually connecting more to who you truly are. A lot of times in the physical reality, a lot of what we do is governed for the most part by our preconceived ideas of who we are and the misconceptions and the misperceptions of who we actually are, often through the ego mind identity. So it's actually a step farther away from the essence of who we really are. And a lot of these other areas, when you connect to them, you're connecting more wholeheartedly to the, I guess, more like the truth of who we really are. So it feels like there's such a strong knowing that connects to that.
Yeah. And you see this or read this in the stories of near-death experiencers, which I find fascinating and really affirming and confirming of the subtle spiritual teachings given to us by saints, sages, and mystics. When they lose touch with their body, which is really what their experience is, on the physical side, the doctors think they've flatlined or in some way are in a deep coma that they're never going to recover from. But on the side of the near-death experiencer, what they realize is they've left the body behind. They left the physical body behind. But by no means have they left themselves behind. And by no means have they left memory and awareness and a sense of their being this new experience. And then it's not like they suddenly became something else. They realized, oh, I've always been this, but never realized the extent, the depth of what it means to be in my subtle self. And they have, for the most part, amazingly wonderful experiences where they feel joy pouring into themselves or love pouring into themselves. And they can immediately understand what it was about the physical body that they identified with, and what about all the rest of their experience, the rest of their reality, that they suddenly saw as distinct from the physical. So then when they come back from their near-death experience, there are a couple of things that happen. But one is, they never fear death again. They realize that death isn't death. Death is just the dropping of a limited physical awareness and the resumption of an expanded subtle awareness that includes, as you said and I said earlier, most of what they know themselves to be. It's their sense of self, it's conscious awareness, it's ideas, memories, emotions. Those never go away. It's just the physical body that drops. So this is a really dramatic confirmation of what we're talking about. It is, we are already that. We just don't realize it. As I put it in the book, we always have one foot on earth and 1 foot in heaven. And that is the kind of duality of our existence until we realize that we can go further into the heavenly realm by becoming less and less aware of the physical realm.
Mm-hmm. We have a new series that's going to be coming up after we're done this series, and it's actually going to be called, we haven't released it yet, but it's going to be called Life, Death, and Beyond, Exploring the Greater Reality. I think it's sort of, this series kind of segues nicely into that one. And yes. We've been doing a lot of work, just even reading a lot of near-death experiencers and sort of setting up the interviews for this section. And I really do find it amazing because, I mean, when you read their story, I mean, it's so tangible. Like they have such a experience that can't be denied. It's like there's a dramatic shift in consciousness. And then immediately, because of such a shift, they perceive everything in the world from a completely new lens. It's like instant. It's also the world of where you see spontaneous healing often occur. It comes from that sort of, I think, this sort of awareness of a deep, deep inherent truth of who we really are. And much of everything you just talked about is really profound that you'll hear over and over again from these stories. One thing that also comes up a lot of times is that there's an overwhelming sense of oneness that usually these people experience when they have that. Very much the same as like the mystic sages and whatnot that have these experiences, or even like you can experience yourself going through meditation and having these connections. I guess my question is, that is definitely, I mean, when you feel it, you can never really take it away again. It's sort of like there's a sensation in your body that you know a certain level of truth now. Why is that sense of oneness, which is really who we really are, seem to be not as pervasive as the degree of separateness that we usually feel from more of the day-to-day? And I would say the average person is more connected to a feeling of separation than they are to a connection of oneness. What's the reason for that, if that really is more the truth of who we are?
Yeah, I completely understand that question, and I get it a lot. The way I kind of boil it down is if we are all that, if we are one with the infinite, if we are essentially spirit, if we are subtly aware of realms far beyond this one, why the heck don't we know it? Why is it so completely hidden from us? The irony is that we did it to ourselves, that from early on at birth, we start creating neural circuits. And these neural circuits tie together various functions of the brain. So one circuit might trigger the ability to move our hands and legs in harmony so we can walk. Another circuit might tie together visual experience with physical motion, where the two have to be tied together. And these kind of circuits are essential to us, because without them, we couldn't operate the body, if you will. We couldn't function in the world using the body without these circuits. But then we go beyond that. After a short while in childhood, we start building circuits that you might think of as pleasure circuits, not in a sexual way, but that we make connections to foods, to people we love, to experience we have that are joyful to us for some reason or pleasing to us for some reason. And we begin to put those circuits together to enhance those experiences, to bring us those experiences. And we create millions of them. As it's thought of in Indian teachings, we basically create physical structures in the brain that support our likes and dislikes. All of this would be fine if it weren't for the fact that those circuits fire with the least amount of sensory, mental, or emotional stimulation. So if we have a circuit, I often use this example that what I call the coffee circuit. If you are a coffee drinker and you like the taste of coffee and you like the, you know, adrenaline lift you get from coffee, you will form neural circuits in your brain that are all interconnected, that connect memories, that connect feelings, that connect ideas, that connect sensory experiences into a massively active circuit that will trigger and make you want to drink a cup of coffee if any of those related associations occur. So if you have a thought about coffee, you want to drink coffee. If you smell coffee, you want to drink coffee. If you have a memory of a conversation that you had while you were drinking coffee, you'll want to drink coffee. These circuits become compelling. That's the key to understand. And that we have created literally millions of circuits that compel our behavior. And those circuits, unless you're fortunate to be raised in a way that taught you how to create circuits that make you aware of subtle reality, the vast majority of people create circuits that make us aware of physical reality.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job. She was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy. But every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And make us aware of our sensory experience, our physical experience, and the experience of others, and the ideas that are all tied together, and the memories that are all tied together with our operating in the world. So this compulsion begins when we wake up. Circuits kick in, say, okay, time to get up, and you start doing your morning routine. Okay, now we have to start thinking about work or what we're going to do today. Circuits kick in. And that, again, far more than most of us would like to believe, we're not making any decisions about what we're doing. All those circuits we've created are making the decisions. And it's only when we really stop, take time to consider what it is we want to do, what is it that we would like to be doing, perhaps to offset the fact that the various circuits that fire automatically, we begin to perceive them as not healthy for us. Maybe they include poor diet, lack of exercise, bad relationships, poor work productivity. All of those become habitual. And if we finally sort of say, no, wait, stop. This is not who I want to be. And until we really say, okay, I am going to deliberately go in a direction I don't normally go. Until we do that, we are much more automatic in our behavior than is comfortable to realize. And it's this automatic behavior that just, it's not that it makes higher awareness impossible. It just means we don't even think about higher experience. We're just pulled along by all these preset experiences that we don't even bother. So then we come to how do we rewire? How do we create new circuits that will, in fact, support reaching out to higher experience? And this is as possible as anything else we do. Mm-hmm. We already wired our brains. And wiring our brains to create all these circuits is just as possible now as it was when we were infants. Nothing has changed. The brain is always plastic. But now we have to be more deliberate about what it is we want to do in order to rewire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot said in that. It's the cycle that we get into, this sort of dislikes and likes, it's this basically the same as when we talk about that pleasure pain cycle that a lot of the mystics have talked about over the years, and how we get stuck very much in seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, and we just kind of stay in the same cycle of sort of, you know, that comfort zone that then we don't really challenge too much. You also kind of talked about then what happens when we challenge these. So I think that's a really important part, because what often, at least I find, is that in my own experience too, when I have challenged those things, it's not always met with complete ease and relaxation. It brings up a lot of stuff for people. So, which sometimes I think people interpret as, this is maybe not a good thing for me, because it steps out of that comfort zone, it steps out of that familiarity. And by nature, when you challenge those circuits, it's going to bring up a lot of stuff. I'm wondering if you can maybe share what that experience can be like when we do start that process, and what maybe people can expect that it could feel like, so that they can kind of keep the pace, you know, they can keep moving forward with it despite what it actually feels like in their body.
Yes. Well, the first thing I always say is do one thing at a time. If you want to, as you say, challenge those circuits, which means, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're trying to resist this automatic flow of reactions. And when you try to resist it, you find it's pretty powerful. That, you know, if you do have a coffee circuit, you say, I'm going to give up coffee. Well, one of the first things that happens is you start wanting that cup of coffee. And then 10 minutes later, you want that cup of coffee. And 2 minutes later, you want that coffee. It's very, very deeply embedded, and it's very strong because it brings our attention to it. So as you say, when you challenge the circuits, you're really up against this habitual flow of your life force to go through these circuits. So that's why I say the first thing that I advise is to just try to make one change. And more importantly, try to make the one change that will have the most payoff for you, that will create the most change in your experience. And the one change that I always universally recommend is that people establish a meditation habit. If you don't already have one, it can be the single most important thing in your life. And the reason is that a lot of people think of meditation as, oh, okay, I sit down and I'm quiet and I relax. And that's true, but it's just the surface of what it means to meditate. What it really means to meditate is that you're plugging into that more subtle reality and you're experiencing it. So when you feel peace, you might go, oh yeah, I relaxed a little bit and that was great. But really what you felt was super conscious peace. And if you maximize that rather than minimize that and keep having those experiences during meditation, your brain will rewire primarily in the prefrontal cortex. It will create neural circuits that not only support the physical process of meditation, but it will also create circuits that respond to and support that feeling of peace and that superconscious awareness. So meditation is so important to self-transformation because it connects you into the highest aspects of who you are. And it does so by minimizing your awareness of the physical body. So when you meditate, you sit still. And as you sit still, the literal connections, the wires from the muscles and the body stop sending so many signals to the brain. And your brain becomes less and less bombarded by sensory input. It is, of course, easier said than done. Anybody who sat down to meditate finds almost immediately that you're a bit squirmy and you don't want to sit still. And the body wants to keep sending you signals that tell you this body needs this or wants this or needs to relax or is breathing or whatever. And all of those sensory inputs tend to make your mind start churning with thoughts, and one thought leads to another. So that train of thought that tends to happen when you meditate is often amplified by any kind of emotional charge you have around such thoughts. So all this conspires to make meditation challenging, because you're challenging your circuits, as you say. You're challenging all those automatic responses that you tend to have, particularly the emotional ones. And a lot of people will, unfortunately, and I always hate it when I hear this, make a person conclude that I'm just not the kind of person who meditates. And what I say in response is, well, if you went to play tennis and you'd never played tennis before, would you expect to hold your own with Rafa Nadal? You know, is there anything in your experience that you can do now that you didn't have to go through a learning curve to do it? Meditation is no different. And in the same way that it might have been difficult to learn to play tennis well, it's difficult for the same reason, that you didn't have the circuits, or you had circuits that were fighting the tendencies you were having while you were playing tennis. So there's a certain amount of overcoming the way we've wired our brain already in any new thing we set out to do. So meditation is no different. But the payoff of meditation is far greater than the payoff of learning to play tennis, if you can ever play tennis, because it gives us access to the superconscious. It gives access to more of what we really are. And then that kind of seeps into everything we do.
Yeah.
Every feeling we have, every thought we have, that level of life force that we experience, all are uplifted. They're all transformed gently, slowly over time until we naturally live more from that higher superconscious state than from the normal conscious state.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. I really like when you had mentioned that it is minimizing the awareness of the physical body. It reminds me, and I would completely agree with you, and that's come up many times, is that really the best path to what we're talking about is through meditation, because you really do need to develop this. It's literally like a skill, again, that we're trying to relearn. And, you know, we live in the society where everything really, we want it now and we want it immediately. And it's like you said, there's a learning curve with all of this stuff. You really do have to sit down and just build those circuits up so that they know what to do better. It's like, if people have ever even experimented with something like fasting, I went through almost a very similar experience doing fasting. My wife and I been practicing in this in different ways, and we did a 7 and a 9 day fast, just water fast. And not that that's even that long, but for the average person, that's still a pretty good chunk of time. A lot of people think you're going to die if you don't have something to eat within a few days. And you go through, you know, you very tangibly experience grappling with the physical body, because you really are putting less physicality in and less focus on the physical body. Because, I mean, food and substance is a big piece of our connection with the physical body. So when you let go of all of that and it's not there, I mean, there's a lot of addiction and itchiness and stuff that, you know, then that you get entangled with that gradually starts to fall away. And eventually it really does feel like it drops and it no longer has the same tethering to you in the way that it once did. And then from that place, you have a completely different relationship with things. You feel like you're actually making more choices from a place of inner authority than sort of this autopilotness that takes place, where you are just going about your business, doing things that seem just normal, but you're kind of a step away from actually really choosing things.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's no substitute for direct experience. So when you know, speaking for myself, I've also often fasted, and not always for 9 days, but 3 day fasts, 1 day fasts even. And I think one of the things that I always experience is that I have a lift of energy. And logic would say that if you don't have food, you should have a diminution of energy, because the sort of mainstream viewpoint of how bodies work is that food is fuel. And if you don't have fuel, the body won't perform as well. But when you fast, and especially when you fast lengthily, like you mentioned, for 9 days, you realize, wow, I really don't need food. The energy that is pouring through me, and in fact, the energy that is much greater than before I fasted, that is pouring through me, clearly has another origin than food. And I think we, in fasting, we, in a small but significant way, we prove to ourselves that we're more than a physical body. There's some other reality of which we are a part, and the physical is only a small piece of that.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you kind of have this tangible experience of at some point with it, where you realize you're actually not hungry anymore. You don't even really care too much about food. And you've actually got this, it hit like after maybe day four. I think I struggled with a lot of stuff, especially up until day three. And then it started to get, all of a sudden it got looser. And what it felt like was actually realizing that there's many different ways that we are nourishing our bodies that we just may not be aware of, or that aren't even online so much when we are very much engrossed in nourishing from a physical capacity. So when you don't have food, all of a sudden you realize whatever it's coming from, whether it's the sun, whether your chakras are receiving energy in a certain way, and you're fueling yourself from this, or you know, negative ions, whatever it might be, something is going on that you are actually fueling yourself, but in a totally different system. And to me, it reminds me of this sort of super conscious awareness, because you kind of tap into something that is quite different than what we've only really known.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think meditation, you do this, the same sort of process happens with that.
Yeah. And until you have that direct experience, it's only an intellectual belief in higher consciousness or more subtle reality. And it's important that you have that, because that's a starting point, but it shouldn't be an ending point for any of us. We should dive into the actual experience of this higher consciousness. Mm-hmm. And as I started there a few conversations back, I highly recommend the first place you start is meditation, because it subtly changes you in many ways. But take the time to really establish that practice. Don't meditate for a week and think, wow, that was good, I liked that, and then get carried away by something else. Really be deliberate about making new circuits. It's a weird way to think about yourself, but it takes weeks to months for the brain to create strong, interconnected circuits that support behavior, and make that behavior, and this is the thing to understand, is that you want to make that behavior almost automatic. Mm-hmm. I've been meditating for so long that it is really hard for me not to meditate in the morning. You know, if I have a really early flight, and it will mean getting up at 2 o'clock to meditate, I will get up at 2 o'clock to meditate, because I really want to. And all those circuits that I've built up over all those years are firing away, and they're supporting in my mind. It's calling up the feeling. It's calling up the memories. It's calling up the thoughts surrounding meditation. It makes me want to meditate. So it takes a while for circuits to become the default behavior. And that's what you really want meditation to become. You want it to be the default behavior, not just something you know how to do, something you do occasionally, but that it becomes a powerful part of your daily life. And that does take weeks to months. So be prepared when you take on any new habit. And I'm talking a lot about meditation because it's the central habit that I think everyone should have. But realize it's going to take a while and that you're going to encounter resistance. Your mind is going to start telling you, oh, you're just not the kind of person who meditates, or I just can't get my thoughts to calm down, or I'm never going to learn to sit still. All these voices come up, and they do so for everyone. But you just need to push through. And there will be magical moments. I can almost guarantee there will be magical moments. It's not all grim business. There will be moments, and sometimes longer than moments, where you get it. You go, oh, that felt wonderful. I felt myself connect to something much greater. And if you're prayerful, praying to God, you might feel just a big wave of response from the divine filling your heart and mind. And those moments are very powerful. The more you meditate, the more those moments you have.
Yeah, I think that really is one of the most powerful things you can do. My wife has done, she was quite a seasoned meditator when I had met her too, and had done many rounds of 10-day silent Vipassana meditation retreats. And I mean, those are pretty intense when you've never done those before. Not to say that's what you need to start with, but I mean, she had, you know, just a spontaneous healing of her vision after the first one she did. She had glasses and came out and no longer needed glasses. Her eyes cleared right up and done. And since then, it still never required them. So, I mean, it really is, like you had mentioned, miraculous. You tap into stuff where miracles take place. So if we're not sort of connecting to that place, we're not so privy to receiving miracles. But I think if we can connect to that place, we sort of open up more of the potential for that, those realities to actually happen. And so I think that's part of where this magic happens, outside of, I think, just being able to navigate your life better, you know. Yeah. Like you're operating from a place that I think ultimately is more in your highest good and more truthful than a lot of times the ego mind identity sort of conditioned self. That's not always got our highest good in the viewpoint, right? Where so when we connect to this other place, I think we are guided in a different way. And then, like you had mentioned earlier, we connect to some of the things like intuitions, you know, which I think is really higher levels of information that goes beyond the linear logical thinking mind.
Yes, I think underlying everything that you just said, and the most significant experiential impact of meditation, is that you feel better. You feel emotionally better. And we are, for the most part, strongly driven by our emotions. And the reason we tend to react in the protecting the ego mode is that we're not feeling enough just being safe in ourselves. We feel like we need to have whatever that was that was being threatened, and we go after it. And it can be different for everybody what that thing is that might be threatened. But the key to understand it is the feeling threatened is what drives our behavior. Where if you're feeling satisfied, if you're feeling fulfilled, if you're feeling complete, if you're feeling at peace, you just respond to everything differently. You're much more able, even if intellectually you thought that you should forgive those who trespass against you, when you're feeling that inner fulfillment, it's so much, it's just natural to forgive those who are making our life difficult or threatening, you know, things we want to accomplish. They just become the things we have to deal with in life, but not threatening the purpose of our life.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really important point, because what you were talking about, safety, because I do think that's like at a, I mean, that's really what constantly triggers that whole fight or flight system and then puts us kind of right into autopilot on protective mode, which is very biologically wired in. What I love about it is it's like when connecting to that, you do sort of find this, also this sense of inner safety that you take with you everywhere. And then what also happens is you're not constantly then looking for something outside yourself to provide that safety. So yeah, I think that's really, really important, because without that inner feeling of safety, I feel what happens is it's inevitable that we will constantly put the solution outside of ourselves onto something else. And that keeps us in a cycle of constantly going in a loop of being, feeling protected, being scared, feeling protected, being scared. Whereas if you've got that inside yourself, everywhere you go, you emanate that out. And like you said, you will interact with everything differently because you have this profound sense of safety and security within yourself.
You're already okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're beautiful. You're already fine. Now, a lot of people, I think, kind of fear that state because they think it will make them placid or non-responsive or uninteresting. And that, as a friend once said to me, you know, what you're describing to me sounds like being a contented cow in the pasture. But the reality is that when you have positive, harmonious emotions, they make you much more creative and much more productive and much more able, because you're not getting in your own way. You're not busily emotionally reactive in negative ways to the inevitable things you have to work through to live a dynamic life. But if you don't react to all those, it's like you are given 90% of your energy back. 90% of your energy is all snarled up in these emotions you have about liking or disliking how your life is going. But if you can be, in fact, more centered in that feeling of safety and joy and positivity, you become a juggernaut. One of the common things about successful men and women is that they don't react emotionally to most of what's going on in their lives. They just cruise through it. It's just one more thing they need to do. Not in a grim way, but it's just, that's the way life is. And to become super creative, super productive, super successful, even super loving, you need to let go of all those unwanted negative feelings that otherwise will hamper you forever. And that's what meditation does. It doesn't just make you placid. It makes you dynamic, because it gives you all that energy back that you're wasting in these negative experiences. And the way you get them is just, you know, immersing yourself in them, in the superconscious. It is our natural state to feel loving, positive, energized, joyful. That's who we really are. And so when we tap into that in meditation, we bring that back into everything that we do and with everyone we do it.
Yeah. Well, and I find that it doesn't, I totally understand what your friend was saying with that. I've heard very similar kind of ideas, but it's not the reality what it feels like. I find even personally being on this path for the past probably 15 years or more, and I still find you have a wide spectrum of the array of emotional scale. I mean, it's not like you don't experience anger or frustration or things, but I find that the attachment to it is so much thinner than what it's like. And so I'm not tethering myself to that and then ruminating and lamenting. And it reminds me of like the Buddha's, you know, second arrow, the suffering that we kind of do to ourselves, you know, where we, by ruminating and sort of staying in the cycle of it, I feel like that part of it kind of disappears. It's not like, you know, if someone that you have a hard breakup or you have someone that you love that passes away, it's not that you don't feel often the full intensity of that emotion, but it doesn't settle in the same way. There's not the same sort of rumination process I find around that stuff in the same degree. Is that kind of your experience with it?
Yeah. No, I think that's a good insight. It's not black or white. You don't suddenly find yourself in a state of consciousness in one day in meditation, you know, one particular day, and then you're done with it all. Two things are happening. One is that life goes up and down. It just does.
Yeah.
It goes up and down. The other thing is that you still have all those circuits that you created that tended to make you, you know, want things or want things in a certain way. And they have a life. And so they will give you flashes of anger, which is much more quickly offset by the feeling of being safe and being at peace and being in, you know, a joy, a happiness that endures. But those other things will happen from time to time. And I think, as you say, the key is to just say, oh, that happened. I just got angry with somebody, but I'd much rather live in this other state of being. And I'm just going to relax back into it. And I'm going to let go of that. And the more we do that, the more those circuits become quiescent. And they don't really go away. It's a big mistake to think rewiring the brain is like directly tackling all the circuits that you don't like. It's really create new circuits, create strong new circuits, so they become the default response in your life. And when you do that, the circuits that automatically generated unwanted experience just become less and less easy to be triggered, until they're rarely, if ever, triggered in your life. But the key is you got to build the new circuits. You don't have the new circuits, the old circuits are just going to keep firing, and you're going to fall into those behaviors, even if you really don't want those behaviors.
This comes to the end of our time for this episode. Please go to inspirehealthpodcast.com and listen to the remainder of this important episode. Thank you so much.